This is a podcast from Deutsche Welle. For more information and a selection of other programs, click on to dwworld.de.
Deutsche Welle. World in Progress.
This week on World in Progress, as cities in developing nations boom, water experts are seeking new innovations to quench urban thirst.
Without water, without enough water for agriculture, it is not possible to feed a growing world population.
We hear about a school in India which empowers the blind to become visionary leaders.
Man kann ja nicht die ganze Welt.
We can't adjust the whole world to the needs of the blind. The blind also have to learn to survive. The campus here helps because it is not as accessible as it seems to be at first glance. If they can master this, they can conquer the world.
And from music to politics, women in Brazil are breaking new ground, demanding respect, jobs, and equality.
A turning point in the fight against violence towards women in Brazil was the case of Maria da Penha, who is one of the most important symbols for women's rights in Brazil.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Saroja Coelho, standing in for Anka Raspa. People around the world are flocking to urban areas, but many cities lack adequate infrastructure to support a growing population. And while city planners struggle to meet local needs, a number of governments are embroiled in disputes with their neighbors over access to watersheds that cross borders. A dispute is growing between Ethiopia and Egypt over access to the waters of the Nile. Israel and Jordan have competing claims to the Jordan River, and the list goes on. This week, experts from around the world are in Stockholm to discuss the impact of water shortages and look for ways to conserve, manage, and distribute the water we have. Alexander Müller works for the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations. He's at the talks in Stockholm and called us here in Bonn to tell us about his impressions.
The World Water Week this year is dealing with a very hot topic. It's dealing with water in an urbanizing world. Between now and the end of this century, the world population will increase from around 7 billion to 10 billion. And all these additional people will live in developing countries and in urban areas. This requires infrastructure, food, water, sanitation, and the World Water Week is dealing with this issue.
Now, there are activists and experts from all over the world participating in the talks in Stockholm, and each of them is bringing a very different set of issues to the table. What kind of challenges are you facing as you and the other participants search for answers about how to deal with the future water shortage?
It's a big advantage of the World Water Week to bring people together from very different areas of expertise, because water is in the center of many developments. For example, food production is not possible without water, so we need water for irrigation. And agriculture is the biggest user of water. About 70% of all withdrawn water resources is used for agriculture. At the same time, there's an increasing demand for sanitation, clean drinking water. So we have a competition on water, and therefore the expertise from different areas is urgently required to develop solutions for a better world.
Now, you said in a recent interview that water is the key to food security. Can you tell me what that means?
Yes, to produce 1 kilogram of beef, we need 15,000 liters of water. 15,000 liters of water for 1 kilogram of beef. Every human being needs 2 to 4 liters of drinking water, but for our food, we need between 2,500 and 3,000 liters every day. So without water, without irrigation, without enough water for agriculture, it is not possible to feed a growing world population. It's very clear the competition on water will increase, and water is very often a transboundary issue. So many countries rely on the same river basin, and without innovation, we will not be able to really provide enough food for everybody.
So what kinds of problems might we see in the future with people across national lines competing for the same water sources?
I can give you a very concrete example along the River Nile basin. 10 countries, now with South Sudan, 11 countries, they have one big river, the Nile. So we know how important the Nile is for the livelihoods in this region. So what we have done is we have assessed the water needs today and possible water availability in 2030. And we will bring together countries in order to work together to share the water resources in a way that there is enough water for all the different needs.
What kind of potential for violence is there in a situation like that?
You know, there are a lot of people telling us that the next wars in arid and semi-arid areas will be on water. And we can see it in many areas of the world. You only have to look at the Horn of Africa. The drought is one of the key drivers of this catastrophic development there. Of course, not the only one. The question of a failing state should not be ignored. But increasingly, droughts and water shortages will be responsible for social unrest and for civil wars.
Now, looking at the situation in the Horn of Africa, I'd also like to ask you, what kinds of innovations have you seen which have been helping people to gather water?
I would like to present an example from the northern part of Ethiopia, where communities are working together to improve watershed management. It's a very dry area with very small amounts of rainfall, but what they are doing is they are trying to collect every drop possible, which means people are working together in the villages to plant trees, to renew watersheds, to better manage water in order to produce more food. So the innovation is collaboration at the community level, water harvesting, better use of every raindrop there, and very, very important, a very long-lasting commitment of all the farmers to share the water resources. So innovation there is not only one technology, of course it needs technology, but it has to be done in a very participatory way. This is the only way in arid and semi-arid areas to really increase food production.
Alexander Müller is the Assistant Director General for Natural Resources at the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations. He's in Stockholm for World Water Week. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for your interest.
Thousands of aid projects around the world aim to teach the blind important skills, from how to use a computer to how to drive a car. But a new school in India is teaching people with visual disabilities how to start their own initiatives, essentially making them advocates for themselves. The International Institute for Social Entrepreneurs was founded by Sabria Tenbakken, who has been blind since she was 12 years old. She now works with her sighted partner, Paul Kronenberg, encouraging visually impaired people in developing countries to become social entrepreneurs. Adriana Woltersdorf has this report, which is presented by Jesse Wingard.
The wind rustles the leaves of the coconut palms above the International Institute for Social Entrepreneurs in southern Kerala. You can hear the clicking of a cane against the ground as about a dozen people hurry into a brick lecture theatre. Most of them are blind or have extremely limited vision. Some also use crutches or struggle with other impairments. They have all come to Trivandrum, the capital of the Indian state of Kerala, to learn how they can establish organisations that encourage entrepreneurial spirit in disabled communities. They intend to use the skills they learn here to encourage equality for the visually impaired in their own countries. Most of the participants in the course have never heard of social entrepreneurs before applying to the Institute. But the course, which takes about a year to complete, teaches them about self-confidence, encourages them to express their opinion, and trains them in fundraising, finances, bookkeeping, and computers. Paul Kronenberg, who is from the Netherlands, co-founded Braille Without Borders with German disability rights activist Sabria Tenbakken. Their work led them to start the Institute for Social Entrepreneurs in order to empower people to help themselves. But Kronenberg says it was a difficult journey.
We didn't want people to see Mother Teresa and think, oh, I want to be like her. We didn't want the wannabes. We wanted people to know who they were. People who say, yes, I want to change something, I just don't have the tools yet, and I want to get them from IISE.
Participants in the IISE's programs come from as far away as Sierra Leone and the United States. There are also people here from Tibet and Germany. But the Institute's co-founder, Sabria Tenbakken, says that despite their very diverse nationalities, the people here share a lot of common ground.
What we seek from these people are creative ideas, drive and passion. They are the elements that draw out creativity.
Tim Berken says passion is the driving force behind the Institute's work. She explains that many here have struggled against discrimination, and that has nourished their desire to rid the world of prejudice.
We were at a leadership conference presented by management consulting firm McKinsey. They started by saying, when you have the job offer from McKinsey in the bag, then you're a leader. We asked ourselves, what makes a good leader? And we said, we see leaders as survivors, people that have been through a lot of hardship and survived, and have discovered passion and vision along the way. What is your vision?
That's the question participants in the IISE's program are asked almost every day. They're given the chance to really examine and improve their ideas. Proposals are constantly being tweaked. They learn to express passion while also holding their own with sponsors who want to know about the bottom line. Upon completion of the program, graduates are given a laptop and encouraged to go out into the world and turn their ideas into practice. For some, it will be the beginning of a new life. It's a demanding program. Students' costs are covered, including meals and instruction. In return, they are told to go out and make their dreams into reality. Cronenberg says if they can survive the rigorous program and navigate the campus, they are ready for anything.
We can't adjust the whole world to the needs of the blind. The blind also have to learn to survive. The campus here helps because it is not as accessible as it seems to be at first glance. If they can master this, they can conquer the world.
So far, the Institute has been quite successful. In 2 years, they have seen nearly 50 people graduate. The alumni have gone on to launch 43 projects in more than 20 countries. Jesse Wingard, reading a report from Adriana Wolterstorff, Deutsche Welle Radio, Bonn.
Still to come on World in Progress, a special report on women's rights in Brazil. But first, here is Holly Fox with some news about development issues affecting the world this week.
Calls for an end to forced evictions in Egypt. Amnesty International has accused Egyptian authorities of failing to respect the rights of some 12 million slum dwellers who face being made homeless by forced evictions. In a report released this week, the rights group urged the government to put the rights of slum dwellers at the top of their agenda in order to meet the demands for social justice and human dignity championed during the 25th of January revolution. The report says that in situations where the only feasible option is eviction because the living conditions are too dangerous, slum residents must be given advance warning as well as compensation and help finding a new place to live. Increased mobile phone access for the world's poor. Some 3 million people living in poverty in Africa and South Asia are to be given their own personal phone number, regardless of whether they own a phone or not. Mobile phones have had little problem penetrating the market in developing nations. Cell towers and phones have made their way to some of the most remote regions of the globe. But many callers borrow phones from friends or pay a fee at local shops, which means they have no discernible identity. By early 2013, the United Nations and telecommunications giant Movertu planned to distribute technology in over 13 markets across Africa and South Asia. The specialized phone numbers will enable users from low-income communities to log in with a password, make and receive calls, access banking information, and even organize small businesses. Horn of Africa drought highlights importance of water access in crisis times. Experts say the food crisis and drought in the Horn of Africa has highlighted the need to respond to early warnings and ensure community water facilities are well maintained and fully operational when disaster strikes. Speaking at World Water Week, which is currently taking place in Stockholm, Sweden, the International Federation of the Red Cross Red Crescent Societies called on governments and donors to help vulnerable communities be better prepared to provide for basic water needs in times of crisis. The group said such communities need knowledge about the maintenance of vital water facilities such as wells and pumps, which provide a critical lifeline during water-related emergencies. Communities across Kenya, Ethiopia, Djibouti, and Somalia have been hard hit by a severe drought and only have sporadic access to functioning and clean water supplies. World Bank offers support for a post-Gaddafi Libya. The World Bank has said it is willing to offer financial support to a new Libyan government if the rebels manage to topple the regime of Muammar Gaddafi. One of the bank's senior directors, Sri Mulyani Indrawati, said Monday that it will use its vast experience in post-conflict rebuilding to deal with Libya when the situation is right and when it is demanded by the people there. Meanwhile, rebels and government forces continue to struggle for control over the Libyan capital, Tripoli. Colombian negotiator flees death threats. Colombian peace campaigner and former senator Piedad Córdoba has left the country after receiving death threats. Córdoba gained international attention when she negotiated the release of a number of hostages held by the rebels known as the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. But Colombian officials ousted the outspoken opposition senator last year, accusing her of promoting and collaborating with Latin America's last remaining rebel army. The death threats come after Córdoba's organization sent letters to FARC and another rebel group, the ELN, urging them to release the hostages they still hold to pave the way for negotiations. Protests against North Korean prisons. Hundreds of South Korean activists held a protest over the weekend condemning North Korea's use of concentration camps. They also called on Pyongyang to release South Koreans who are believed to be imprisoned in them. The group was led by residents of the hometown of a South Korean woman believed to be trapped in the north. Amnesty International estimates the north's prison camps house some 200,000 people. It is believed most of the prisoners are not criminals, but people perceived to pose a political threat to the Kim Jong-il regime. At least 500 South Koreans are believed to be detained in the camps.
That was Holly Fox with the development news. In recent years, more development aid than ever before has been directed at women. By the time they are 12, many girls in developing nations are tending house, cooking, and cleaning. They eat what's left after the men and boys have eaten. They are less likely to be vaccinated, to see a doctor, or to ever attend school. The World Bank says putting earnings in women's hands is a good way to fight poverty, especially in developing nations. Women tend to reinvest a much higher portion in their families and communities than men, spreading the wealth beyond themselves. This could be one reason why countries with greater gender equity tend to have lower poverty rates. With that in mind, World in Progress takes a closer look at women in a growing economic powerhouse, Brazil, where women are making far-reaching gains. In this next report, journalist Milton Bragacci asks whether the new age of femininity is dawning in South America's largest economy.
Many funk and rap songs in Brazil establish women as sexual objects, in a music style dominated by male rappers. With the hit song Sofeia Mas Tô Na Moda, I'm Ugly But I'm Trendy, Tati Quebra Barraco was the first female rapper to break into the music charts, subverting the roles and politics of power in the funk rap universe. Reversing the game, she was the boss, and in her lyrics, men were the sexual objects. But after leaving a feminist impact, Brazil's first lady of hip-hop recently disappeared from the music scene after several plastic surgeries. Traditionally, Brazilian women are under high pressure to look sexy. The country is the second largest market for plastic surgeries and cosmetic products in the world. And if the stereotype portrays Brazilian women as carnival beauties wearing nothing but a bikini and dancing samba, for feminist Silvia Pimentel from the United Nations Committee on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, this image does not reflect reality at all.
Some TV explore this image of women. We are fighting against this. It is how the media works. It's impossible that a country as Brazil can admit such exploration of the women's image.
The streets of Salvador, Bahia reverberate the powerful sounds produced by big, heavy drums. This rhythm moves throngs of thousands of people, especially during carnival. Ability, talent, and a very vigorous physical strength are some of the requirements to play in an Axé musical band. So tradition goes that drummers must be all male. But this one is a very special group, Banda de Dá, formed only by women. Set up several years ago, the all-women band is now a regular part of the city's culture, proving that things are slowly changing in society. Women in Brazil are increasingly taking jobs that until recently were dominated by men, becoming bus or cab drivers, starting out in the police force or working as security guards and construction workers, for example. And the most symbolic advance is the recent election of the first female president of Brazil, Dilma Rousseff. In her inauguration speech, Dilma Rousseff acknowledged this symbolism.
Já registro, portanto, o meu primeiro compromisso após a eleição.
Let me state, my first commitment after the elections is to honor Brazil's women, so that today's unprecedented result becomes a normal event. I would like for parents to look into their daughters' eyes and say, yes, women can.
Nos olhos delas e dizer, sim, a mulher pode.
But many of the advances in women's rights over the past decades are seen by some feminists as more symbolic than substantive. Even though women now make up 40% of the workforce, only a few are managers or directors. Female workers earn only 2/3 of the male wages for the similar jobs. And despite the female president, women in Brazil are still underrepresented in politics. They hold only 45 of the more than 500 seats at the country's House of Representatives. Since taking office in January, the new president has named 10 female ministers to serve as part of the 38 cabinet members. That's a doubling from the 5 female ministers serving under her predecessor and mentor, Lula da Silva, during his 8 years in power. In the year 2000, no women served in Brazil's cabinet. Today, women hold key positions such as the Institutional Affairs Ministry, in charge of negotiations with Congress, and the Cabinet Chief. While women in office help raise the profile of women in politics, Silvia Pimentel believes the election of Dilma as the first female president is not necessarily a result of more participation and conscience on the part of female voters in Brazil.
This is a circumstance that Dilma is there. Of course, she's a very well-prepared woman, as everybody knows, but she would never be the president if she would not be appointed by the President Lula. So it is not a revolution or an evolution that women are now coming like this to the high positions in my country. No, it's not.
I ask people walking on the sidewalks of Avenida Paulista, the main avenue in the very heart of São Paulo, financial center of Brazil, what they think of the attitude towards women rights and equality in the country. Rebecca, a science graduate student, told me why women earn less in Brazil.
Maybe it's machismo, maybe just men usually have this, they have this impression of being objective and direct, and women are more subjective and sensitive. And maybe it's a problem related with this gender characteristic.
Stereotype.
Yes.
Renan, an 18-year-old office boy, explained why Brazilian women worry so much about their look.
I think there is still a lot of prejudice. It's becoming less, but if a woman is not sexy or pretty, she doesn't get a good job, so she feels an obligation to modify herself to look sexy.
Brazil has pioneered some of Latin America's most advanced legislation and mechanisms to ensure women's rights and gender equality. The first women's police stations in the world were created here in the early 1980s. Now there are 450 women's police stations in the country, staffed by specially trained women police officers addressing crimes against women. Before the implementation of women's police stations, many incidents of violence against women were treated with indifference by male officers. But because of increasing public awareness of crimes against women, many victims now dare to speak up. A survey conducted by Fundação Perseu Abramo Foundation estimates that more than 2 million women are subjected to sexual and domestic violence or other forms of physical and psychological violence every year. In 2009, more than 200,000 women called the government hotline to report cases of aggression and violence. A turning point in the fight against violence towards women in Brazil was the case of Maria da Penha, who is one of the most important symbols for women's rights in Brazil. The 60-year-old pharmacist wears light makeup and glasses and speaks calmly but confidently.
Meu nome é Maria da Penha, Maia Fernandes.
My name is Maria da Penha Maia Fernandes. Like every woman, I thought my marriage would last forever. But in 1983, I woke up with a bullet in my back. I was shot by my husband. I only discovered that a year later, after an investigation, because my husband told the police there had been a robbery.
In the early 80s, her ex-husband beat Maria da Penha continuously and finally attempted to murder her twice, causing her to become paraplegic. With the law and large parts of society against Maria, it took 2 decades to bring her husband to justice for his crimes.
Esta luta demorou 19 anos e 6 meses para acontecer.
The fight went on for 19 years. The situation only changed after pressure from the international community. How did it happen? The first trial was 8 years after the crime. Even though he was found guilty, he left court a free man following an appeal. I was so disappointed that he could walk out a free man. So I wrote a book to tell my story and describe the violence he inflicted on me and my daughters.
Maria da Penha's case was sent to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights, which considered Brazil responsible for taking effective action to prosecute and convict perpetrators of domestic violence. This was a landmark ruling which contributed to the international consensus that governments have a legal obligation to take active measures to protect women's rights. Maria da Penha has become an eminent figure in the Brazilian women's movement. And in 2006, President Lula da Silva signed the Maria da Penha Law with the intent of reducing domestic violence. Among the changes initiated by the law was an increasing punishment for those who practice domestic violence towards women and protective measures for family members at risk of becoming victims of violence.
A lei da condenação do Brasil.
Brazil was condemned internationally and was forced to change its laws. It's my aim that Brazilian society, its men and women, unite against violence against women. The Maria da Penha Law is to protect and free women from domestic violence.
E fazer com que essa mulher tenha uma vida livre de violência.
Maria da Penha is one of the thousands of strong women standing up and making a difference for justice and equal rights throughout Latin America. And many more are following their example of determination and courage, proving that women have long gone beyond stereotypes of submission and being sex objects. Their struggle and contributions are already bearing fruits for generations of women in the continent and around the world. From São Paulo, Brazil, Milton Bragatti, Deutsche Welle Radio.
Sou feia, mas tô na moda. Tô podendo pagar hotel pros homens, isso que é mais importante.
Thank you to Milton Bragatti for that report. Music there from the legendary Tachi Quebra Bojaco, I'm Ugly, But I'm Trendy. And that brings us to the end of this edition of World in Progress. I'll be standing in for Anka Raspa again next week with a report on Burmese refugees and other interesting stories from around the world. From today's Bonn studio team, Eliana and Oliver, and from me, Saroja Coelho, thank you for listening.
Sou feia, mas tô...
You've been listening to a podcast from Deutsche Welle. We hope you enjoyed the program. You'll find more information and podcasts at dwworld.de.